I want to read you something from a book that was given to me. The book is called The Speed of Trust. And it's about trust in relationships and business circumstances and how it impacts the speed with which accomplishment is made. And it's by Stephen Covey. Actually, it's Stephen Covey who is the son of Stephen Covey, if you have read any of the other books. But there's some very... You know, I started out to say, well, you know, I'd like to go ahead and address the concept of trust. And I spent that studying through, and I only got about a third of the way through the book, and yet I had some notes. But then I began to look at trust in a more defined sense. And one of the elements, one of the legs of the stool, so to speak, on which trust is based is integrity. And I really... There had a story in here that struck me so much that I wanted to share that. So I do. I want to focus my sermon down to a smaller pillar of that, in that sense, integrity. You know, essentially, what do we do? What we do when no one is looking? There's a quote here by Warren Buffett. Those of you who heard him know he's one of the richest men in the world, but he's also known for his integrity. He's known for the fact that he drives around the car that he's had for a number of years, lives in the house that he's lived in for many number of years, hasn't been very pretentious in his lifestyle. But he says, I look for three things in hiring people. The first is personal integrity. Second is intelligence. Third is a high energy level. And if you don't have the first, integrity, the other two will kill you. And so it's the element on which you balance the judgments and decisions that we make in this life. But then Stephen Covey goes on and he relates a particular story that I'd never heard before, and yet I took it and I put stars around it to remind myself there in the book to remember this story. So I'll share it. It says, in the third round of the 2005 Italian Masters Tournament in Rome, tennis champion Andy Roddick was paired against Fernando Verdasco from Spain. It was match point in favor of Roddick. When Verdasco hit his second serve, the line judge called ball out and the crowd began to cheer for Roddick. Velasco moved toward the net to shake hands as if the match was over. But Andy Roddick didn't accept the point. Instead, he said that the ball was in and he called the umpire's attention to a slight indentation on the clay court, which showed that the ball had landed on and not beyond the line. Surprised, the umpire allowed Roddick to overrule him, and the point was awarded to Verdasco. Everyone was amazed. In a game not typically played on the honor system, but on an umpire's calls, Roddick had made a call against himself, and he went on to lose the match. Though Andy Roddick lost the match that day, he lost the tournament, because he called it on himself. But what he said was true. And it cost him because of his integrity. His personal integrity cost him that match. Though Andy Roddick lost the match that day, he gained something far greater. He gained credibility. In our society, how much do you think credibility is worth? Well, we want to have credibility, but would we really pay that price to have it? Would we pay everything to lose that which we had desired? He gained trust. How did this display of integrity gain him credibility? Look at it this way. How are the umpires going to respond the next time Andy Roddick challenges a call? Most likely they'll treat his challenge with the utmost respect because his reputation is known, his credibility will precede him. Also, how do you think Andy Roddick felt about himself? And this is what is really important. How might he have felt if he chose to accept the win, knowing all along that the ball really wasn't out? Integrity. What's it worth? How much will we pay for our integrity? Andy Roddick's behavior on the court that day has become a symbol to me of what I now call the Roddick choice. Demonstrating integrity even when it's costly. Would you pass on the tennis tournament and your opportunity to participate in the championship of the tournament in order to have your integrity when nobody would ever know the difference? No one would ever know that ball did not go out. But you still have to go home that night and look yourself. I look at myself, each one of us, in the mirror. How much would we pay for integrity? I've probably given a dozen sermons on putting God first, different ways, different elements of it. Frank's given a dozen sermonettes on putting on Jesus Christ, taking on the nature of Christ. There are certain things that we tend to crystallize our focus on. A number of the sermons I've given, if you call them sermons, would probably be at the Passover. Now, I will be out of country this year on the Passover, so you won't have that same sermon this time. But they'll get it in Nigeria. Because that's the core when we talk about baptism, making covenant with God. I look at putting God first. But if we were to take that and say, well, there's a stool, so to speak, under that, and there's a number of legs that are pillars. There's decisions that we make in order to accomplish that task. You know, what would one of those very core values be? And that would be personal integrity. The personal integrity. What we do when no one is looking, when no one will ever see, when the only one who will even have a clue of what took place is ourselves. I mean, physically, obviously, God is always looking. But we are used to that, right? We can sign off of that from time to time if we choose. What do we do when no one is looking? James 4, in verse 13, takes on a little different light, a little different meaning in this context. It says, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go do such and such, go to such and such a city, spend a year there, we'll buy and sell, make a profit, kind of laying out your plans, and plans are important. It says, but whereas you don't know what will happen tomorrow, or what is your life, it's even a vapor that appears for a little time and vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or do that in the context of His will. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, in our conscience and in our focus and our thoughts, to him who knows to do good, to him who knows that that ball really landed on the line, even though the umpire called it out, and does not recognize it, or admit it, or own up to it, or fix it, to him it is sin. Take it in the context of not the fact that we're being judged for our sins, that we're going to pay for our sins. Take it in the context of, it is you and I who have to make that choice on was the ball in or out, and when nobody else is looking, what will we say? To him who knows means in our own mind. What is it that we understand? When we know better, then we should be accountable, not just because God will judge us. We should be accountable to ourselves. If you're not accountable to yourself, you will never submit yourself fully to God. That process never takes place. Again, the issue here is not about getting caught, you and I getting caught. In many ways, you and I can find ways to get by with who we are. And we can hide and shelter and you know, soften the image or approach that is given to others. The issue is not even so much about whether or not God is looking. Obviously, He is. Personal integrity is something that we do ourselves. Not that God doesn't strengthen us, not that He doesn't open and teach us or open our mind and show us, but it is something we have to decide to do for ourselves. It's a matter in that respect of honor. It's a matter of integrity. What we do when no one is looking. Now, there was another story in the book, and it's why I tended to focus on this chapter, because I kept coming back to the examples, and I thought they were just so remarkable that they made me stop and take a look at myself. It says, a great example of integrity, both in keeping a commitment and in standing for something. What do you represent? What does your name stand for? When they say your name, what comes to mind? It's John Huntsman, chairman of Huntsman Chemical. As he relates in his book, Winners Never Cheat, following lengthy negotiations, Huntsman agreed to sell 40% of a division of his company to Great Lakes Chemical. A simple handshake with Emerson Campen, chairman and CEO of Great Lakes, sealed the $54 million deal. Just a handshake. All the paperwork would then have to follow. Two men made an agreement. However, Great Lakes dragged their feet in preparing the written agreement. In the 6.5 months it took them to get the deal down on paper, the price of raw materials decreased substantially, Huntsman's profits tripled, and Huntsman's margin reached an all-time high. 40% of the division increased in value from $54 million to $250 million in 6.5 months. With the deal not yet signed, Campen called Huntsman and said that while he didn't feel that he should pay the full difference in value, he thought it was only fair that he should pay half. Now, you own the business, millions of dollars are at stake, you made an agreement on a handshake, you're getting ready to sign on the dotted line, the person that you agreed with says, look, it's only fair, I can't pay all of this difference, but I should pay half. He offered to split the difference. Huntsman said no. He said they had shaken hands and agreed on $54 million and he would stick to the price. Campen said, that's not fair to you. Huntsman's response was, you negotiate for your company, I'll negotiate for mine. Campen was so impressed with the display of integrity that even though he and Huntsman were never personally close, he prearranged for Huntsman to be one of the two people to speak at his funeral. John Huntsman turned down $98 million in order to keep his word. That's impressive. He's not even converted. I dare say that we would rather do business with him than some maybe who are. Personal integrity. It's worth a lot. How much would we be willing to pay? What if the value of the deal in the 6.5 months had gone down? What if the company had run into trouble and now the deal was worth $5 million or $10 million and change? Well, I could say that we would certainly hope the other man would have kept his word as well. Certainly have no way to know. I guess what's most important is if it was our deal, would we have kept ours? Would we have kept ours? Life can be lonely at times. When you take a stand, when you stand someplace and everybody else begins to move, when you have a conviction and others don't share it, when you have a value and it goes against the grain of those that you are in the midst of. You know, life can seem very, very lonely at times. But even when life is lonely, you still have to look in the mirror. You still have to stop and stare at yourself and see who you really are and who I am as well. In the book of Psalms, chapter 15, those examples were so dramatic to me to just literally almost just stop me, and you couldn't help but begin to ponder that and then ask yourself, would I do that as well? I mean, God working in me, would I still do that? $98 million to keep your word. Psalm 15, verse number 4. Excuse me, verse 1 through 4. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell on your holy hill? Who's actually going to be there in the kingdom? Who's going to be a part of your church? Those who are close and serve you. He who walks uprightly, works righteousness, speaks the truth, where? On your lips or in your heart? It's different, isn't it? Anybody can speak it on their lips. But do you believe it? And not only do you believe it, is it who you are in your core sense? Is it part of your integrity? Speaks the truth in his heart. He who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. Doesn't laugh at bad jokes, does laugh at good ones. Doesn't just laugh to be polite, just to be polite. Truly responds according to kind. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change are the ones who are going to be there. And the ones who won't, won't. That's what it says. Verse 5, he who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. And it goes back and says, you know, these type of character traits, this kind of integrity, he who does these things shall never be moved. Never be moved. You're not going to be pushed aside. You're not going to slip and fall spiritually. You're not going to turn away or step aside. Shall not be moved. Human reasoning tells us sometimes, quite frankly, it's just too hard to absolutely do the right thing. It's just too much in business, in a relationship, in a friendship. Sometimes human reasoning tells us it is just too hard to do the right thing. In some cases, just to even do what God simply says. But you know what's harder than that? Not doing it. Now, maybe it's not harder at the moment. It's easier at the moment, possibly, to do the cut, to take the corner, to step aside. Sometimes it's easier. To not face what is in front of us. To not own up to our mistake. But it's harder as life goes on because the payback continues. Sin produces pain. Sin produces pain. And sometimes we're in pain and we can say, well, we're being persecuted. But sometimes, maybe most of the time, if we're in pain, and I mean beyond the fact that we injured ourselves because we fell off our roof, poor Mark, okay? But it's because of something that we actually have done. Genesis 3, what a fundamental example, something that I don't tend to go back to, but it's very, very clear. Verse number 16, after Adam and Eve sinned, God says, all right, that's going to be painful. Now, maybe at the moment it was easier to just kind of accommodate Satan and take his way because it was desirable to respond to that. It says, to the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. Oh, does that mean childbirth just became harder physically? Oh, I don't know, maybe. Maybe what it's really talking about, though, is it's going to be harder to raise children because of your sin. Because they're going to see what you have done, they're going to learn it from you, and they're going to begin to do the same, and sin causes pain. In pain you shall bring forth children, your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. It just talks about the relationship. It's not going to be the way it should have been. He said to Adam, because you heeded the voice of your wife, have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. It's going to be hard work. You're not necessarily going to know what you should have done right because you're going to decide for yourself, and it's going to bring pain. Thorns and thistles it'll bring forth for you. You will eat the herbs of the field. In the sweat of your face you will eat bread. Till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, to dust you shall return. Till the day you die, there will be a price to be paid for the sin. So, you know, it's nice to say God forgives us. When we repent, he certainly does. Does that mean all the social consequences of everything we've ever done are going to then disappear with it? Clearly not. A girl called, sent me an email recently. She was doing a report for school on Vietnam. Someone mentioned to her that I was a Vietnam veteran, that maybe she called me, she could interview me and answer the questions. She did. We connected over this last week. And she began to ask me about what we did and what the impact was and what the effects was. And she said, well, was there any longer-term effect from having been over there? I said, well, my wife says there is. I said, well, you know, there's one thing that we learned. We learned to steel our emotions. I said, because if you don't function in that kind of environment, and the men who couldn't didn't do very well at all. But I said it was a kind of washing process out of that over years of time, even after God called me. And we can go back and we can say, well, yeah, but I was baptized and God forgave me and I went on with my life and I served Him in the church. But the fact is we deal with circumstances that exist in our lives over a process of time. Now, we overcome, we grow, we serve. God is merciful, but sin produces pain. Blessings flow from doing that which is right and good. Proverbs 5 goes back again, showing some of the damage that is done, but then it turns around and said, well, why don't you secure a blessing instead? And it mentions how that would be done. Proverbs 5, verse number 1. It says, my son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding, that you may preserve discretion, that your lips may keep knowledge. Listen to me so that you're going to have a blessing instead of a curse, because sin produces pain. Blessings come from doing that which is right and good. Integrity is doing what you know to do. If you know to do good and you do it not, it is sin. Well, it's sin regardless if you don't do what's right, but it's what you know that is important, because this is personal in that way. The lips of an immoral woman drip honey, implies that it looks sweet, seems to be pleasant. Her mouth is smoother than oil, but the end she's bitter as wormwood. Sharp as a two-edged sword, her feet go down to death, her steps lay hold of hell or the grave. Lest you ponder her path in life, her ways are unstable. You do not know them, and you don't want to know them. Therefore, hear me now, my children. Do not depart from the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her. Do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others, and your years to the cruel one. Years of payment, punishment, and sorrow. Lest aliens be filled with your wealth, and your labors go to the house of a foreigner, and you mourn at last when your flesh and your body are consumed, and you say, oh, how I hated instruction, and my heart despised reproof. I have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to those who instructed me. I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the congregation and the assembly. Goes on in verse 15 and it says, well, why wouldn't you choose the blessing? Well, the difference oftentimes is the difference between integrity and a lack thereof. Because what is it we do when no one is looking? What is it we do in that sense for ourselves? Because of what we believe and what we understand. Drink water from your own cistern. Running water from your own well. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? You're going to take and just pour out your blessings in the streets and let them run down the side? Let them disappear away? Let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed. Rejoice with the wife of your youth as a loving deer and a graceful doe. Let her breast satisfy you at all times. So it says, always be enraptured with her. For why should you, O my son, be enraptured with an immoral woman, be embraced in the arms of a seductress? Why would you do that? Basically is what it says. Blessings flow from doing right and good. Trust is built in part on integrity, on the knowledge that the right thing is going to be done because it's good. There's another example. Came out of the same chapter. again, one of the better chapters in any book I've read recently, and I may still have a chance down the road to follow up on the bigger issue of trust. But he mentions here, he says, I recently came across a story of courage related by the wife of a man who was in medical school some years ago. And again, integrity takes courage. So he's describing how to have integrity. You've got to be willing to be courageous enough to follow through. She said, getting into medical school is pretty competitive. The desire to do well and be successful puts a great deal of pressure on the new incoming freshman. My husband had worked hard on his studies and went to attend his first examination. The honor system was expected behavior at medical school. The professor passed out the examination and left the room. Within a short time, students started to pull little cheat papers out from under their papers and from their pockets. My husband recalled his heart beginning to pound as he realized it is pretty hard to compete against cheaters. Everybody can look into their own heart back when you were in school or if you are in school. You can ask yourself, did I ever cross the line? Did I ever cross that line? So about that time, a tall, lanky student stood up in the back of the room and stated, I left my hometown and I put my wife and three little babies in an upstairs apartment and I worked hard to get into medical school and I'll turn in the first one of you who cheats and you better believe it. They believed it. There were many sheepish expressions and those cheat papers started to disappear as fast as they had appeared. He set a standard for the class that eventually graduated the largest group in the school's history. The man who stood up in the classroom that day later became a respected physician. Certainly he did what was neither comfortable nor easy, but it demonstrated the kind of courage required by integrity, the kind of courage that affirmed timeless principles, lifted others, and made life better for all of us who depend on a physician's knowledge and skill when our health and our lives are at stake. The person who's getting ready to operate on your knee, if you'll have a Irene's surgery, do you want to understand that they cheated in medical school? That they cut corners on what they learned on their tests? No, we want them to have integrity, obviously. You know what? What we should want the most is for us to have it as well. Every one of us, absolutely trying to do it. We can say, well, do it for God, but the fact is, at some point, you have to do it for yourself. You have to do it because that's who you are. That's what you want. And not because somebody's going to make you, not because someone's going to punish you if you don't, not because somebody's going to catch you, but because it is what you represent. That's integrity. Without integrity, there will be no trust. What do we do when no one is looking? The book of Ezekiel has an account here that I remember reading way back when in terms of Easter. And I've always kind of remembered it. Ezekiel 8. But I think it's interesting because it describes compromise and sin in a way that is done to hide it. Ezekiel 8, verse number 1. Came to pass in the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I sat in my house with the elders of Judah, sitting before me, that the hand of the Lord fell upon me there. This is in captivity. There's a broader context, but the point here stands well. I looked, and there was a likeness like the appearance of fire from the appearance of his waist down and upward, fire, and from his waist and upward like the appearance of brightness, like the color of amber. He stretched out the form of a hand and took me by a lock of my hair. The Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, brought me in visions of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the north gate of the inner court, where the seat of the image of jealousy was, which provokes to jealousy. This is an idol. This is an idol at the north gate entrance to the inner court of the temple. Do you know what was sitting at the entrance of the north gate at the entrance to the inner court of the temple? The altar. That's where sacrifices were made. So in the place of the altar, or next to the altar, whichever it was an image here, as an Asherah, or an Ashtoreth, which is an idol, sitting in its place. Behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision I saw on the plain. He said to me, Son of man, lift your eyes now toward the north. I lifted my eyes toward the north, and there north of the altar gate was this image of jealousy in the entrance. Furthermore, he said, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary, to drive me out of their own presence. Now turn again, you will see greater abominations. You know what's even greater? This is still in the open. It's in the place of the altar where the sacrifices were to be made, but even greater was when they began to hide it. The greater abominations were then hidden. He brought me to a door in the court, and I looked, there was a hole in the wall. He said to me, Son of man, dig into the wall. When I dug into the wall, there was a door. He said, go in and see the wicked abominations which they're doing inside, where nobody is looking. I went in, saw, and there every sort of creeping thing, abominable beasts, all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed around on all the walls. There stood before them 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel, and in their midst stood Jezaniah, sounds right, son of Shaphan, each man a censer in his hand, a thick cloud of incense went up. He said, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark, behind closed doors? Every man in the room of his idols. Every man maybe had a different idol. Maybe they each had a little different desire or perversion, but they were doing it in the dark. God says, that's even worse than out before everybody. For they think that I do not see. For they say, the Lord doesn't see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. He said, turn again and you'll see greater abominations than what they are doing. He brought me out to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house, and to my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. And he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again, you'll see greater abominations than these. And he just goes on and lays stack after stack after stack of idolatry, one on top of the other. Asherah, or Ashtoreth, is a form of the god that is used as an idol, Ishtar, which is Easter, where it comes from, weeping for Tammuz. Is it not interesting that before the resurrection of Jesus Christ, there was an idol that by history was resurrected every spring? He would die in the fall at the end of the season. He would be resurrected in the spring at the beginning of the season. And so there was already in place a resurrection custom when Christ died and was resurrected from the dead. Boy, is that a coincidence or what? You don't think Satan's going to help us along if we're willing to compromise in any way at all? And so Tammuz was the husband and brother of Ishtar by tradition. And there's different traditions. So what we have is, again, it says, look at these. Look at what they're doing in the dark. And they say, well, God's not around here anymore. He doesn't see us. We can just do it, and no one will ever see. Luke chapter 12, God says, it's simply not going to be that way. That's simply not how I'm going to let this play out, especially, frankly, with my people. I had given a sermon last week. At the end of my sermon last week, I mentioned one prophet claiming to be a prophet and the damage he had done. Another person who claimed to be an apostle, the damage he had done. Another person who claimed to be one of the two witnesses, the damage he had done. Because it's cybercast and because it's open, I left it at a more neutral prospect than just strictly naming names. I put a message on Elders Forum and I used the illustration and I named the names. And it went around within the ministry, which is confidential. And I put it out as a warning. Let's be careful that we're not looking outside the gates if the problem is behind us. Let's make sure that we're watching for this kind of threat to God's people and to the church. elder called from Lubbock, where we had previously pastored, and said, you know, I'd like to share this with a couple of members here. Is that okay? I said, yeah, it's all right. So we did. The memo went around the world instantly. Somebody immediately posted, it seems, on a website or a chat group, and that memo went everywhere. And I'm getting memos back now from other ministers out there. I said, do you understand? Somebody just, Michelle, I came home yesterday, and Michelle's talking to somebody on the phone, a friend of mine from college. He said, somebody just sent me this memo. Now, why would they even send it to me? It has nothing to do with me, but they just want to make sure that I know. So I'm getting memos coming back, and I said, okay. I tell you what, if I have to be on record for such a thing, I certainly am willing to be so. It is true. But it's interesting, God says, you know, sometimes that happens with our sins. He says, sometimes the things that we're doing that are wrong, that lack integrity, sometimes those hit the airwaves as well. And God, in various ways, possibly even makes allowance for that, so that we would recognize that sin produces pain. It certainly opens it up in that respect. But Luke 12, verse number 1, Christ said, beware, starting down toward the end of chapter, verse 1, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. The opposite, in some respect at least, of integrity. There is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be known. Therefore, whatever you have spoken in the dark will be heard in the light. What you have spoken in the ear, in the inner rooms, whispered in somebody's ear, inside the privacy of the room, will be proclaimed on the housetops. You know, I still say integrity is something we must do for ourselves. But the fact is, God says, you know, what I'm doing, the accountability that ultimately is going to take place is certainly going to be much, much broader than that. Got the oil changed Thursday on my Saturn, went down to the dealership. I have the good blessing of having bought a one-time price on an oil change, and they will change the oil for forever, as long as I keep that car. Hope to keep it a long time. So anyway, I went down Thursday, they changed the oil, came back out, they hadn't vacuumed it, sloppy, slush all around. I said, well, at least vacuum the inside. They ran real quick, vacuumed the inside, handed it back. Is that okay? Anything wrong? Everything okay? No, it looks great. Friday they called me. Well, how satisfied were you? Give me like a 1 to a 5. Is there anything that we didn't do for you? I said, no, you did every single thing you could have. That's a 5. He said, well, would you recommend this to someone else if it came up? I said, well, certainly I would. You know, are Saturns the best cars around? I doubt it. I've never assumed that I was buying the best car around. I suppose if I got Consumer Reports and looked at all the little dots they color in, that Toyota's somewhere above that. But the fact is, I like the Saturn. I like the fact that I have to haggle for the price, that it's set, it's guaranteed, it's not going to budge or move no matter who buys it. But what I like is their commitment. Now, I'm not trying to sell Saturn. I don't care if anybody drives a Saturn. I'm buying one. Still buying it. This is number 4. But I'm sitting there waiting for the vacuum, and they got one of these new magazines out, and I grabbed it. But it says here at Saturn, we believe that you have to change in order to get better. Nothing improves by remaining the same. Now they've changed this magazine. But it says, although the magazine looks and feels different, there's one Saturn constant that remains the same, our commitment to you. I'm on Saturn number 4. Basically, well, I like the cars. That's okay. I don't think they're the best cars around. They're probably not, but they're good. But I like the fact that they're going to do whatever it takes. I know that. I walk in the dealer. I know they're going to take care of me. I know that if the warranty expired at 36 and I talk to them at 34 and the bearing goes out at 40, they're going to fix it. And they did. I know that. I know that they're going to call me up. And they don't want a number 4. They want a 5. And if it's not a 5, they're going to ask me, what is it that we can do? What needs to be done to make this right? A 4 is not good enough. They want 5. They want a perfect score. and they're going to fix it if they can. I know that. So a Sky will probably be our next car, you know. Michelle and I will be driving our little Sky Roadster around.
Right.
But I just say there was a commitment there. I look at that corporately as integrity. So I go back there with my business each time. Now, integrity in a corporation is to make a profit. Integrity among God's people is in order to do the right thing. It builds trust. It brings blessings. But we don't do it because it feels good. We do it because it's right and because it's what we want to be. It's who we are. Proverbs 11. We don't do it for our mates or our children. We don't do it for our friends in the church or our community. There's side benefits in all those places. But we don't do it for them. We do it for us because of what we personally represent. I'm not talking now about self-righteousness. That's not my point. Talk about integrity. Proverbs 11, verse number 1. A false balance is an abomination to the Lord. A just weight is His delight. When pride comes, then comes shame, but with the humble is wisdom. The integrity of the upright will guide them. Kind of makes choices easy. You don't have to say, well, I'm going to lose $98 million. You just have to say, I'm just going to do what I said I would do. I will do it and follow through. It doesn't make you wonder, oh, I didn't need to spend that money, or I could have saved that money, or I could have done something else. Just says, I'll do what I said. But the perversity of the unfaithful will destroy them. Sin brings pain. Riches do not profit in the day of wrath. Righteousness delivers from death. The righteousness of the blameless will direct his way all right, but the wicked will fall by his own wickedness. The righteousness of the upright will deliver them, but the unfaithful will be taken by their own lust, taken and punished, in that sense, by their own hands. Who we are determines what we do. Come back in the car, I was asking Jerry, he says, to thine own self be true. Now, that's not a Bible verse, but why would they use thine? He says, well, it's in Shakespeare. And because we didn't make it to church today and we got stopped at Pullman and came back and he went home, took a nap and laid around. But he pulls it off somewhere here. And it's advice of a father to his son in Hamlet before he goes on a voyage. It says, neither a borrower nor a lender be, for loan oft loses both itself and friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. This above all, to thine own self be true. He's given a list of things and principles to his son as he sails off. To thine own self above all, to thine own self be true. And it must follow as the night the day that you canst not then be false to any man. If you're honorable to yourself, for yourself, then you will be honorable. You will not be false to any man either. I thought that was, you know, interesting. Shakespeare figured that out. Had it all in place. Wrote like it was a scripture. Put thine in there so we'd be tricked up. At the end of the day, whether you've had profit or loss, whether you've had pleasure or pain, at the end of the day, you still have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror. When you lay down there on your own. Now, certainly, you might be next to someone, you might be in the midst of a home or a family, but it is you who goes to sleep with your own thoughts. It is me. It is integrity. It gives us peace. 1 Thessalonians 2. Paul is writing the Thessalonians, and in the New King James it says his conduct here effectively then among the Thessalonian church. 1 Thessalonians 2. For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain, But even after we had suffered before and were spitefully treated in Philippi, as you know, we were bold in our God to speak to you the gospel of God in much conflict. For our exhortation did not come from deceit or uncleanness, nor was it guile, but as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but as God who tests our hearts. Down deep inside, he said, is where this begins. Down in our heart, this is our conviction. And we're not doing it to make somebody happy or pleased or for appearance sake. For neither at any time did we use flattering words, as you know, nor a cloak for covetousness, God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others, when we might have made demands as apostles of Christ. We were gentle among you, just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children. So affectionately longing for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you have become dear to us. For you remember, brethren, our labor and toil, for laboring night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you, we preach to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses. And God also, how devoutly and justly and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe. He's talking about integrity, deep down in the core. As you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father does his own children, that you would have a walk worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory, so that you could take the example that we have set and you would apply it and live that way as well. You're not going to openly say such a thing, I would hope, unless you could openly represent that that was true. And Paul says, you know this, you're our witnesses yourself. You can't make up integrity. You can't really pretend integrity. Hypocrisy is where you say one thing but do another, and it becomes obvious, generally speaking, to those around. Matthew 12:33. The only way that we can have integrity is if it is the real thing. And it comes from way down deep inside. It becomes from the decisions we make when no one is looking, when nobody sees. Now again, God always sees, but this is in the context of the fact that some things are hidden and some things are exposed. Matthew 12, verse 33. Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or else make the tree bad and its fruit bad. A tree is known by its fruit. Brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things. An evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth evil things. I say to you that for every idle word men may speak, they will give account in the day of judgment, for by your words you'll be justified, by your words you'll be condemned. But where do the words come from? They come from deep down inside. They come from our heart. Our integrity is who we are at the most basic level. Our integrity shows what it is that we will do when no one is looking.